The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
The publication of this lecture, titled Mashiach, was made possible through a donation made by Rabbi Matthew Hoffman in honor of his parents, David and Naomi Hoffman, and his grandmother, Mrs. Ida Brosterman, and through an anonymous donation given in memory and Le'ilui Nishmos, Elimelech Yosef Umanucha Horowitz, Aleichem Hasholom, of blessed memory.
One of the most precious and cherished words in the Hebrew language is the word Moshiach, or Messiah. It conjures up images of peace on earth, the end of thousands of years of exile and persecution, and the beginning of an era of unprecedented spiritual and intellectual growth. Its very mention has inspired hope and dreams in the hearts of Jews across the world, even in their darkest hours. It is also one of the least understood words in a Jew's vocabulary. Is there a difference between the Christian and the Jewish concept of Mashiach, Messiah? Will the era of peace be immediately ushered in, or will it be preceded by wars and suffering? What kind of a person will Mashiach be? A warrior? A scholar? And what will his role be in introducing and perpetuating the Messianic era? To gain any understanding of the man and his times, we must first study and analyze the Messianic concept from its original source, Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. I would first like to begin our lecture with a section of the Torah that deals with a covenant that God made with the Jews before they entered the land of Israel over 3,000 years ago. This covenant, or bris, is a defining agreement that guaranteed an immortal place for Jews throughout human history and beyond. This covenant, which is described in great detail in the Torah, consists of two parts. One, the Jewish people's responsibilities, and the other, God's. For this reason, the whole document of the Torah, which outlines both our responsibility, the mitzvahs, as well as God's promises, is called the Book of the Covenant, or Sefer HaBris. And that is why the Jewish people as a whole are called the B'nai Bris, or B'nai Brith, the people of the covenant. If we accomplish our responsibilities, the fulfillment of the mitzvahs, the commandments of the Torah, God promised to take care of the Jewish people, both spiritually and physically, in a special and magnanimous manner, culminating in the utopian era of Mashiach. If we don't live up to our promise and commitment to fulfill the Torah, then God in turn promised that we will suffer as no nation on earth has ever suffered. Rav Moshe ben Nachman, commonly known as Ramban or Nachmanides, one of the major biblical commentators, pointed out over 700 years ago that just like that part of God's promise, the unprecedented suffering of the Jews has been fulfilled beyond any doubt, so too can we rest assured that the positive parts of that covenant will also be completely fulfilled. The parts of the Torah that deal with the curses and suffering that will befall the Jews if they don't live up to the Torah is called the Tochacha, or rebuke. There's a fascinating story related to that section, the Tochacha, that I would like to share with you. In all of Eastern Europe, few cities had a place in Jewish life like the city of Vilna in Lithuania. Called Yerushalayim de Lita, the Jerusalem of Lithuania, Vilna, known far and wide as the home of the greatest saint and scholar that Eastern Europe ever produced, Rabbeinu Eliyahu, the famed Gaon of Vilna, at one time was blessed with hundreds of balabatim, plain citizens, shoemakers, storekeepers, wagon drivers, who literally knew the entire Talmud Baal Peh verbatim. But alas, that community shared the fate of all the other Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. By the time that the Russians had liberated Vilna from the Nazis in 1944, almost nothing was left of Vilna's noble past. Shortly after the first wave of Russian troops had taken over the city, a young rabbi, originally a student of the Telšių Yeshiva in Lithuania, who had spent the war years wandering through Russia, entered the city, eventually become Vilna's post-war chief rabbi.
As he came into the city of Vilna, saw that there was nothing left. There were no Jews left in Vilna. The shuls, the synagogues, had already been plundered. There was one store, office, that was full of pieces of the Sifrei Torah. They took out the Sifrei Torah from the various shuls, had used this area as a storage place, and had cut out from the Sifrei Torah in the form of leather, and it was for soles of shoes. They had just taken all the leather there and just reused them. The Nazis used them for shoes. There were pieces and bits of one Sefer Torah, another that perhaps one could construct out of all of this one Sefer Torah, you know, a little bit of this one, a little bit of that. But that was basically all that was left of Vilna. That rabbinic student, though, found one shul, one that was intact, hadn't been touched. It was a small synagogue that people had been ushered away in the middle of davening, in the middle of prayers. They had closed they had chained and locked the shul, and somehow, through some bureaucratic glitch, they never bothered going back there. Having identified a place, and he got someone from the Russian army to break open, you know, to saw open the chain, he went in there, and it was like a scene out of Twilight Zone. It was the Siddurim, the prayer books were all open, the Chumashim, the Torah text that everyone had at his place was all open, and the Sefer Torah was open on the bima, on the table where the Torah, it was still open. Everyone had been taken out. And it was left as it was. It was basically like you're looking in the shul in the middle of davening without the people. And he opened this. This is the only Sefer Torah and the only shul in all of Vilna that had once been, you know, the Torah capital of Lithuania, which itself was a place of tremendous Torah came out of Lithuania. And as he walked up, he was struck by the fact that where they were reading from the Sefer Torah, it was open to that section of rebuke. It was open to the Teufacha of what happens if you don't keep the Torah, what's going to happen. And all the list of curses. It was just amazing. The one who told me this, his name is Rav Isaac Osborn. He is one of the Rosh Yeshivas, one of the deans of the Telšių Yeshiva in Cleveland. He's an elderly, he's in his 80s already. But it was just an amazing, amazing story. It was the only, you just see walking in, this is the only Sefer Torah in this whole deserted city, and that's where it was opened up. But after the Torah describes what will happen to the Jews when they don't keep the Torah, It continues on at length to what eventually will happen to the Jews when they return to the Torah. And that is really the section that we begin with on the first page. And we can read some of it together. And it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee. And thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, while you're amongst all these nations, whither the Lord thy God hath driven thee. Because this is the prediction, the Jews will be driven all across the globe. And shalt return unto the Lord thy God. Because eventually the Jews will return and shall obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thine heart, thine soul. Then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity, have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. If any of thine be driven out into the utmost parts of heaven, from thence will the Lord thy God gather thee. In other words, here is the prediction, which goes the kibbutz goliath, the ingathering of all the exiles. And the Lord thy God will bring thee unto the land which thy fathers possess, and thou shalt possess it, and will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. In other words, the Jews will return, and they will be productive, and the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart. The idea of the circumcision of the heart is a poetic expression for sensitivity. It will develop a religious sensitivity. And the heart of thy seed to love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and thy soul, thou mayest live. And the Lord thy God shall put all these curses upon thine enemies, them that hate thee, which persecuted thee. And it goes now full circle. The Jews eventually will come back to Israel, will prosper, and there will be eventually a judgment against the nations that persecuted the Jews. This, you could read the rest of this. This is, I'm just a part of this, is in the Torah the prediction of the Messianic era. So here it's predicted that there will be an end to history. The Jews, the Golus, the exile will be reversed. The Jews will go back to Israel and they will prosper and their enemies will be cursed. But we know not only of a messianic era, but of a Moshiach, of a human being. What is his function exactly? And in the Torah itself, there are two allusions to the Messiah as a person and what his function is. One is, here on paragraph B on the bottom of the first page, the scepter shall not depart from Yehuda. This was the blessing, the deathbed blessing of Jacob, of Yaakov Avinu. And he spoke to every one of his sons and to Yehuda. We're called Jews. You know, the word Jews is from Yudin. It's from the word Yehuda. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. The tribe of Yehuda will always have a leadership role in terms of teaching, in terms of political leadership, and that will last until shall come Shiloh, and unto him shall be the gatherings of the people. This is commonly understood, this is how Rashi quotes this, this is how the Talmud understood, Shiloh is a reference to the Messiah. The word Shiloh means to whom the kingdom, the power, shall be his, and the Shiloh. This is how Rashi explains. What? Others explain the word Shiloh. Him. Shell and low. There are others who explain it from the word, it has the idea of, we know that there's an expression for a placenta, or it's called a shilya. There are others who want to make some sort of a linguistic link between the two words. But it's referring to, at least this is what's commonly understood, the Messiah. and all the nations shall gather unto him. And the understanding is, what will the nations, what are they doing, what will they come to him for? It's to get guidance, to get inspiration. Because the vision of Mashiach is a modern, latter-day Moses. Not in terms of a law giver, as the Torah has been given, but rather one who teaches the Torah, who guides the people, who inspires the people. And not just the Jews, but all of mankind. So here we have, so far we have one image of the utopian messianic era. The other is of the person that all of mankind will stream to. There's another image, though, here on page 2. And this is taken from the prophecy of Bilaam. Bilaam was the non-Jewish prophet who, this is the story that's related in the section of the Torah called Parshas Bullock. This is in the from Numbers 20, 21, 22 till 24, 25, that Bilaam was hired to curse the Jews by Bullock, the king of Moab. He was afraid of a Jewish invasion. But when he came to saw the Jews, he was inspired, and this prophecy, this whole blessing of prophecy is recorded. One of those prophecies is, I shall see him, but not now, referring to a specific person. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Shaith. Seth, Shaith, is mankind. In other words, he looks at him now as a warrior. And this is the vision. The word for star in Hebrew is kohav. One of the famous false messiahs was a person who is known to us as Bar Kokhba. This is in the year between the year 131 to year 134. There was a uprising led by a person that the Talmud calls Ben Koziva. When Rabbi Akiva, the famed Rabbi Akiva, saw him, he claimed that this Ben Koziva is actually the Messiah. We'll discuss this later on tonight. And he referred this pasuk, this verse, to, refers to, this, the Kochav Miyakov, this star refers to Ben Koziva, this person, Shimon Ben Koziva. We know him as Bar Kochva, really, from Christian sources. Eusebius, the church historian, 4th and 5th century, the 4th century says, calls him, refers to the uprising, and calls him clearly Bar Kokhba. And that's why it's in our lexicon, Bar Kokhba. But it came really from this verse. So here we have another role of Messiah. Not just a teacher, but a warrior. This idea now, these three ideas, this, again, this utopian age, the ingathering of Jews, peace amongst the Jews, the idea of this teacher, and the idea of the warrior, are all, and again, and eventually these wars, and those, not only the that there will be really wars between the Jews and Israel. And the idea that the curses that will be heaped on the enemies, that's alluded to in the first page, means not from some natural catastrophe, but merely will be through the Jews. These ideas are echoed in the words of the prophets. And the just important thing is to understand at least from traditional, you know, point of view, the prophets did not say anything new. They may have seen the vision and a certain clarity, but the ideas are all alluded to in the Torah. It's a ramification of these ideas. So here we have, here on paragraph D, near the second page, and shall come to pass in the last days, you know, the Akros Hayom, in the end of days, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it should have, like, poetically an exalted place, exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. This is the Lundus Lo Yikas Amin, all the nations. And many people shall go and say, come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways, he will walk in his paths. And the rest is the famous verse that's recited every time we take the Torah out. Ki mitzion teitze Torah dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Because from Zion the Torah shall come out. It's not a Torah just for the Jews, it will uplift all of humanity. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall decide among many peoples. And the question of this was Shofar, not referring to God, but to the Mashiach himself. And they shall beat their swords unto plowshares. And this verse is quoted in the, as you walk into the United Nations, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither they shall learn war anymore. So here we have the idea of, really all three ideas are here. The idea of peace, the idea of all the nations streaming, and the idea of judging amongst the nations. Who is Mashiach going to be? I know Rabbi Chaffney just disqualified himself. And here we have another prophecy from Isaiah, that Moshiach will come out of David. David HaMelech, King David, was promised the rulership, to be the king, not only in his lifetime, but forever, as his progeny. The Moshiach will become out of David. So come forth a rod out of the stem of Yishai, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And again, if you could just read this yourself, he will be a person that the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. This is the spirit of wisdom and understanding, of counsel and might. He is a person who really we could look at as a true leader, not just a political leader, but a spiritual leader as well. And again, just the ideas that we've developed before come again together. Really, in all the prophets are just re-emphasizing and reiterating the ideas of the Torah. And again, and associated with him, but just at the end here on page 3, at the end of the top paragraph, and it shall come to pass in that day the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, Hamath, the islands of the sea. In his time, not only will he create a state, but all the Jews will be gathered together. So again, we have the idea again of gathering of the nations. Here we have in Yechezkel, who's on the bottom of page 3, again, another vision of the Messianic era. Here he begins with the Jews coming from all lands back to Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. This is in paragraph F from page 3. And the idea, again, of that their hearts will be circumcised. Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor the detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. And again, at the end, you see the idea of my servant David shall be their prince forever. On page 4, we have in greater detail, and this is taken from the prophet Zechariah, the idea of the war. Now, up until now, it seemed that it was a piece of cake, so to speak. He's going to come in, he's going to rule, it's going to be wonderful. But there is another part to this. And this is really the Battle of Armageddon. This is the... this is on page 4. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, he that is feeble among them. At the day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, in other words, they should, as the angel of the Lord before them, and shall come to pass in that day that will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And here is it's the prophecy that there is going to be a terrible war. You know, I don't know if you realize this. The verse that we say, which is common, the beginning of the Kaddish, Yiskadal Yiskadash Me'rabon, that is taken from a verse in Yechezkel. I just go to the beginning of it on the previous page, who also speaks about the great war. And after the defeat of the enemies of that war, when the Jews will be able to prosper in the land and the evil will be destroyed, it says that God's name will be Niskadashti v'Niskadalti. He says that my name, I will be sanctified and I will be made great amongst all the nations and throughout the whole world. This is after the victory of the war. When we say Kaddish, Yizgadol Yizkada, Shmei Rabbah, we're referring to the post-war era. So we don't speak, but it's really alluding to that, to these events. I says we're going to deal with different issues of this, but I hope, like from these few citations, you have a sense of what's going to happen and what is expected of Moshiach, in other words. So, for instance, if Rabbi Chachnik goes and says, when he'll change his mind and he'll say, no, I am Moshiach, we'll just look back to the pages and say, you know, has he lived up to all that Moshiach is supposed to do? Because this is what Moshiach is supposed to do. And these are all, and it's all taken, these are the original sources. I mean, there are more sources that I've culled. How are we supposed to look at Mashiach? Okay, there's going to be this whole new era. And perhaps the great wars that preceded will not be so pleasant. But the end, this eventual messianic era is something that both the Torah and the prophets speak of in great awe. But as we live our day-to-day lives, how are we supposed to look at all of this? So I wanted to quote you here on page 4, on paragraph H, a fascinating quote from a Gemara in Shabbos. This is in Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph in 31a. Rava said, when man is led in for judgment, and is after one's death, and the soul is brought up to be judged, he is asked a series of questions. He is asked, did you deal faithfully? Like, you know, with integrity as in business. Were you honest? Did you fix times for learning? Was learning part of your life? Was it taken haphazardly? Was studying Torah like part of, you know, I mean, there's so much time to eat, you know, so much time to, you know, like how much time was there for learning? Was that part of your life? Did you engage in procreation? Did you raise a family? And part of the thing, this is part of the thing, is not only just merely raising a family, but did you educate the family? How did you guide your family? Did you hope for salvation? This is the underlying. One of the things they ask you, were you waiting? Were you hoping? Were you happy with the status quo? Like life is fine, everything's okay. Or were you dissatisfied? You wanted more. You wanted the salvation. The Rambam, in explaining why Jews want the Messiah to come, his opinion is that since, as we're going to say, that when the era begins, it will be an era of peace. It will be an era where it will be full of knowledge. And it will be an era where there's a tremendous opportunity for every one of us to be able to grow spiritually without the problems of day-to-day life, or the problems of Golus, or the persecutions of the diaspora, the historic Jewish problems. It's an opportunity to grow. And therefore the yearning for the Messianic era is really a reflection of one's yearning to become a better person, to become a more godly person, to become a more learned person, and realizing that there are all kinds of limits that are set because of a person. Let's say a person who has a desire to learn, tremendous desire to learn. The thing is, I have a wife and kids. I have a family. I have responsibilities. Even if I set aside time to learn, how much time can I have? And the will, you know, the thing is, oh, if only life would be different, you know. If I'd win that lottery, you know. And if I had the time and the money, then I would spend it doing things I really wanted to do, and I've always been putting off to do. That sense of longing is what Jews long for in the Mashiach. This is how the Rambam understands this. The Ramban, Nachmanides, lived 100 years later, understands it a little bit differently. He looks at not so much an opportunity to do more mitzvahs, in other words, for more growth, but he looks at it's really the time, basically, to cash in, to enjoy. Not sensually, but spiritually, we'll all be in sense prophets. We'll all have that that sense of spirituality, the pleasure that comes that we don't have in this world. You know, just this is not this class. There's a parallel to something when I was here in summer. You know, those who had near death experiences and claimed that they saw a being of light. And those who even claimed even further that they were in the other world found it so attractive and so beautiful that when they came back to Earth, were sorely disappointed. I have an interesting story. This goes back 14 years ago. After a meeting with someone, who was telling me a real story. About there's a city that's about an hour's drive from Detroit called Flint. Buick has their plant in Flint, Michigan. And there were two doctors, two friends. Neither one were particularly religious or spiritual people. One of the doctors got into a terrible car accident, and the other doctor was on call. It was when his friend came in, and he was hanging, you know, by a thread. I mean, he was comatose, he was out, and he worked, and he was a surgeon, and he worked on him for many, many hours until he was able to stabilize him. And finally, I don't know, the patient came to. And his first words, you know, he expecting it after it came, his first words looking at that doctor with terrible anger. His friends, they were two old friends, they used to be friends. And he asks, why did you bring me back? He was angry at him. Both were really secular people, and the doctor was taken aback, you know, and he heard his story, and then had this, you know, what we call this near-death experience, started doing his own research, and found that his friend was not the only one who had such experiences, and significantly changed his life. But that sense of peace, of beauty, of pleasure, which those who come back can't describe, is what we will be experiencing in the Messianic era. And at least this is Ramban, Nachmanides, that's what the Jews yearned for. So according to Rambam, it's for opportunity, and according to the Ramban, Nachmanides, it's really for the experience. Every Jew is required, and this is a part of the Rambam's 13, you know, principles of faith, not only to believe, not only to believe that there's going to be a Messiah in the Messianic era. I mean, that's part of what the Torah says. But to be emotionally involved in it and to long for it. You know, there's the famous song which is taken from the which is taken from a re-description of the Rambam's, you know, formalization of these 13, you know, principles of faith. The one dealing with the Messiah is Afal pi shiyisma mei, even though he tarries, im kol zach hakaloi, so I wait for him, behol yomim, every day I wait for him, shiyovai, that he should come. The idea of waiting for him is really based, again, this is a verse taken from the prophets in the bottom of page 4. It says, Ki oid chazoin lemoyed, the vision is yet for an appointed time, and says, but at the end it shall speak and not lie, though it tarry, wait for it, because it shall surely come, it will not tarry. In other words, it will come, and don't worry. But the idea is chakeloi. Chako is wait for it. It's an emotional thing. It's when is it coming already? It's in a certain sense of, let's say you have someone's supposed to pick you up, right? And he says, listen, I can't stop. You know, there's a lot of traffic outside. I'm not speaking about Hidden Hills. So there's a lot of traffic outside. I'm just going to stop for a second. I'm going to beep the horn and run out and go into the car. So he made up, he's going to come. You hear a beep. You're ready, you open the door, you run out, wrong car. Go back in. You hear another beep again. Another beep. He go on 1,000 times, but you know it's going to come, right? It doesn't stop you because you're convinced it's going to come. You get a little anxious, a little ish. I'm nudnik, you know what I mean? When is he going to come already? But says the sense that you're waiting for it, you're waiting to hear the honk, so to speak, and to rush out. Sometimes there's some false signals, you know. But the attitude was that it's coming. That really has been true. That is the Jewish attitude. I'd like to briefly touch on another subject. Then we'll go. That's the idea of Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet. What is the role of Eliyahu HaNavi? You know, on Passover, on the Pesach, from the Seder, we have a special cup for Eliyahu. You know, the kids used to say, like, he came and drank a little bit of it. I don't know if it was your experience as a kid. The real reason why we have the cup is not that he really needs to get a drink.
That's why
we
should take
it. We have four cups of wine, which correspond to the Parshas Bo'era, and this is in Exodus chapter 6, there is God tells Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, says that I am going to take out, he says, I am finally going to take the Jews out. And it's described, there are four expressions that are described in the process of taking the Jews out. Behotseisi, I'll take them, I'll be tzalti, I will save them. Begoalti, I will redeem them. Belakachti, and I will take them for a nation. And they're understood that these four expressions deal with different levels. First, the Pharaoh stopped subjugating the Jews. Because they're still in Egypt, but he stopped demanding they do the slave labor. The second was when they left Egypt. The third is when the army chased after them and the army was swallowed up in the sea. This is the Goalti. They were redeemed. Egypt no longer was a factor. When they came to Mount Sinai, that's Vilakachti. As I took you now for a people. We have four cups of wine that represents the Arba Lashonas Gula, the four expressions of the redemption process. But if you look in that parsha, if you look there, there are really five expressions. The fifth is Vehevesi Eschem El Oretz. I will bring you unto the land. That's a fifth. But that fifth was never entirely fulfilled. Not only we went there, we left. But even the land, which was originally promised to Abraham, was a much larger expanse of land than the Jews originally settled into. Abraham was promised 10 nations, and he was only, but the Jews only at the final stages were only given 7, as the 7 Canaanite nations. The other surrounding nations, which will eventually be given to the Jews, and the promise of Abraham when that will be fulfilled, was not given then and there. So the Vehevesi, I will bring into the land that I promised, was only partially fulfilled, but not entirely fulfilled. When will it be fulfilled? When Mashiach comes. Who's going to usher in the Messianic era? This is Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet. And that's why we have that fifth unfulfilled cup that we don't drink, but it's only symbolically on the table to remind us about this fifth promise. We call the unfulfilled promise the cup of Eliyahu, of Elijah the prophet. That's why we have the fifth cup. But Elio plays an important role in our understanding of the events. In the book of Malachi, this is the last book of prophets, it describes in detail what the role of Eliyahu will be. And we'll just briefly touch upon it to give you a sense of what he will do. Because on page 5, behold, I will send my messenger to prepare the way before me. He will come, he evidently, according to the fulfillment of this prophecy, he will lift up the Jewish people. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come into his temple. In other words, even the messenger of the covenant whom you delight in, referring to Mashiach, behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. So he's going to send in a messenger. God will return to the temple. In other words, the Shekhinah will return, the divine will return back to Israel, and Mashiach will come. And if we just skip down to the second paragraph here, just towards the bottom, we'll just read this together. Remember ye, this is the last words of prophecy that was given uttered to the Jewish people. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb. This is Mount Sinai for all Israel. Statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. The great and dreadful day refers to this whole wars, this whole upheaval. And he will be there. What will he do beforehand? And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, the heart of the children to their fathers. In other words, fathers who have been distanced from their Jewishness, from the Torah, but have children who have returned. He will bring the parents back to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers. Children who have gone away, will bring them back to the fathers. And he says, and this is the, and this change will be affected, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. In other words, it's this is the last words of the prophet, that I am sending out through this prophet, just like all the prophets who came in the time of the prophets, to inspire the Jews. Before this terrible time with the wars, the messianic wars, which will usher in this era, I will send somebody to start influencing the Jews, to bring them back. Lest those that aren't influenced, lest those that don't have that spiritual sensitivity be caught up in this whole, you know, in the curse that will smite the land. How are Jews supposed to look at the Christian Messiah? We've just spoken about the Jewish Messiah. What was he supposed to do? Well, if we look again at what a Messiah is supposed to do, you know, he is supposed to be involved in this war. He's involved in bringing the Jews back to Israel. Involved in bringing the Shekhinah, you know, the divine presence. That, what? Right. But the whole idea that we've gone through this past, you know, 45 minutes. I know it's 45 minutes because the tape's not over. What did he do? He didn't have tremendous influence. The influence in his lifetime was not to non-Jews, it was to Jews. It wasn't a political influence. If at all, one could say, at least from the description of the New Testament, he was a political martyr, but he certainly wasn't a political leader. And in view of all that which we've studied here tonight, he made a really poor showing. So what is the Christian claim of the Messiah? You know, in business, there's a saying that if you're stuck with a lemon, you make lemonade. The followers of the founder of Christianity were stuck with a real lemon. He didn't do anything. He was supposed to have been this Messiah, supposed to usher in this age, supposed to be this political and spiritual ruler of all of Jewry. Didn't do too much. A real failure. So what they did was they created an entirely new role for Moshiach, for the Messiah. A role that's not described anywhere in Scripture. He became now a new divine figure whose purpose of coming was to atone for the sins of mankind. It's a totally different function. This is not the messianic function. There were verses that they pointed out to allude to this new function, but you know, amongst Jewish commentators, just read the any verses that allude to any of this type of atonement don't refer to any Messiah or godly figure. It refers to the idea of when saints suffer, and when saints suffer, there is a causes a the death or the suffering of tzaddikim in the language of the scripture is a form of atonement. How that works is really a complicated issue, which I hope I'm speaking for the JLE on Sunday night. Was it 7 o'clock?
Sunday night.
About suffering. But that, you know, that's a whole different topic. It's like, why do good people suffer? And that's really a very complicated subject. But any of those verses don't allude to any Messiah or to any, you know, to any godlike godlike son of God figure. It's referring to the saints, to just people. And it's a whole difficult problem. It's a philosophical, which really needs its own, like, its own treatment. But really there's nothing when it deals with Messiah that he's done. So what they did is created an entirely new non-Jewish theology, which didn't exist before, that he now is the Son of God. And he, through his suffering, becomes the sacrifice that will atone for all of humanity. That really has nothing to do with the Jewish Messiah. And that's why Jews never accept, with small exceptions, really never accepted him, because in the Jewish sense, it was ludicrous. It's ludicrous, A, he's not the Messiah in terms of what we look through in Scripture, and B, the whole theology as a son of God, or the suffering to atone as a human sacrifice, to atone for all the sins just because you believe him, is a very foreign to Judaism. Because the Jewish idea is that the way to atone for your sins is you have to do tshuva, you have to change, you have to turn your life around. That's what does it. You can't just believe in, you know, there's no bringing a sacrifice. I mean, and the human sacrifice is unheard of. So the whole idea was really totally unacceptable, and it was rejected. We do have, though, another Messiah in history, which was accepted by some, if not many, Jews, and that was Bar Kokhba, which we alluded to before. Bar Kokhba led it was a failed rebellion, but one which cost the Roman legions dearly. And he was very close to victory. The Roman historian Dio Cassius, describing the one Hadrian who defeated Bar Kokhba, when he brought a message back to the Roman Senate about his victory, there used to be a common phrase that if you're in good health, and we also are in good health, this is when they used to come to victory. They deleted that opening sentence because the army had suffered terribly through Bar Kokhba. And Rabbi Akiva believed at one time before his defeat that he was actually Mashiach. The question is asked, you know, we have a person here who, Rabbi Akiva and perhaps many of Rabbi Akiva's colleagues, who believed in the Messiah, turned out to be wrong. You know, what does it say about Rabbi Akiva? You know, about their judgment, about how to know when the Mashiach comes. The Rambam's, Maimonides' approach to this is a fascinating approach to the problem with Rabbi Akiva. And in fact, what he points out to was really that Rabbi Akiva was wrong, was duped perhaps, but not technically wrong. And the reasoning is as follows. We, in a judicial system, are required to accept evidence. When witnesses come to you, witnesses whose background is impeccable, whose testimony has gone through vigorous cross-examination, there's no reason in the world that you should not believe these witnesses. The Torah requires you to accept that testimony in a court. In other words, there's no court system. The whole court system is predicated on the fact is that there's acceptable testimony. But even with all the safeguards, there's knowing that these people, they have no record of stealing or lying or whatever, that they've been thoroughly cross-examined and been questioned. Nobody has come forth to contradict them. Yet in all, it's not 100% foolproof. People have historically have come and lied to the court. Maybe it's rare, but it does happen. So ultimately, the court never really knows if any one witness is telling the truth. There's an assumption of truth, but there's no true knowledge of truth. Because we don't know for sure, but we assume it's so. And as we've done all that's humanly possible, so we assume that's the case. But even so, there are things that, you know, people go through, fall through the cracks. In other words, it's even with all the safeguards, you know, if someone is determined to lie to the courts, they can lie. You know, I mean, there's nothing, we can't stop that. We can, you know, do our best we can, but we can't really stop someone who's truly determined. So when we accept evidence, we accept evidence because the Torah told us to accept the evidence, not because we know for sure this is so. Similarly, when we deal with the idea of Mashiach, we really will never know if he's Mashiach. In other words, but if he's gone through his past, all the tests, so to speak, then there's an assumption he's Mashiach. So the Rambam, therefore, approaches Rabbi Akiva, the problem with Rabbi Akiva, as follows. He says, Rabbi Akiva had all the reason in the world to believe he was Mashiach. Evidently, he was a very learned person. I mean, he's doing it in retrospect. I don't know if there's any sources that he was learning. But the fact is, Rabbi Akiva assumed that he was Mashiach. He was a very learned person. He was a very spiritual person. He was a person who waged a war that was almost successful against the Romans. And therefore, Rabbi Akiva didn't know for sure he's Mashiach. But he was under the assumption, tentatively, of being Mashiach. You had this person gone on, had Bar Kokhba been true, and won the war, and brought the Jews back from the exile, and rebuilt the temple, then he would know for sure he's Mashiach. So he was really under the assumption that he was the Messiah. Like, to the best of our evidence, he was, but that doesn't mean that Rabbi Akiva was wrong. In other words, he just worked with the best evidence that he had. And he felt under those circumstances, it's assumed the person's Mashiach, and therefore what makes a difference is the one should support the war effort. In other words, if the person is a maniac, a megalomaniac who's pretending that he's Mashiach, then he's endangering everybody. If we assume this person is Mashiach, then we should go to his side. How the Rambam says that we assume the person is Mashiach, this is the Cheskas Mashiach, if he is this great Torah scholar and he went to fight the wars and he is winning. You know, he seems to be doing all the right things. So Rabbi Akiva erred, but it was an error that could only be determined after the fact. To the best of his knowledge, at least this is Rabbi Akiva's opinion, he was the Messiah. He made a mistake, but at least that he had serious grounds to assume that he was the Messiah. I'd just like to finish off, though, with a third Messiah in history, and then we'll leave the floor open for questions. And that's the false Messiah Shabtai Tzvi. Here we find, again, this Shabtai Tzvi seems to have been a tremendous scholar, a person with great charisma. It seems from the writings, and it's hard to know, you know, in the past, that he was a person that either suffered from schizophrenia or was bipolar, he was a manic depressive. I mean, it just seems from later writings he was seriously ill. But when he was good, he was really good. He was hot. And he was brilliant, and he did a great job. You know, if they'd be doing a movie now, he would get top billing. And he really was. And there were many people that thought that he had, you know, he had a lot of potential. Unfortunately, though, he never won any wars. You know, this whole idea really was even fight anything. Even according to the Rambam, the person has to be a leader in the political sense. And when push came to shove, and he was offered by the Sultan of Turkey, that either he convert to Islam or he give up his life, he converted to Islam. That much pretty puts a damper on the movement to support Shabbos Yitzhak's Mashiach. Really kill it. But what was disturbing is that in his frenzy or his own belief that he thought he was the Messiah, he felt that he had the right to suspend the laws of the Torah. You know, the story is that he pronounced God's name the way it's only pronounced in the temple. He ate food which is normally not allowed to be eaten. He did a lot of funny things. But in all probability, because he wasn't really mentally ill. The unfortunate thing was that the many Jews had their hopes, you know, that he truly was the Mashiach. There were European Jews that sold all their belongings, they gave him nothing, went to Turkey to follow him, and then when the debacle occurred, you know, they were left penniless. The Jews were scorned afterwards, you know, by the Christian neighbors. You know, it was just terrible. There's a basic premise which the Talmud itself says. This is more in Tzadik Zion and Beis Sanhedrin in 97b, that Jews hope for the Messiah, await all that's that's involved in this, the idea of growth, the idea of opportunity, the idea of spirituality, but we shouldn't make calculations as to when he's going to come or identify who he, you know, and it's just basically is we have to lead a spiritual life ourselves, which is really part of the longing of Mashiach. We'll be worthy, says Mashiach will come. I'd like to, is there any questions?
Wanted to just add two points. First of all, please spend a few minutes at your convenience looking at the handouts, because one of the topics is Tchiyas HaMeisim, which is the resurrection of the dead. So for those, I suggest especially to read that at around 12 o'clock midnight. It'll have the proper impact. In a certain sense, in hindsight, when we look at the concept of a false Messiah, we wonder, like, how could they have been fooled? Like, wasn't it obvious that they wasn't the Mashiach, that he wasn't the Messiah? And really, in a sense, we have the opposite problem. The reason why the Jews at the time were very susceptible to possibly thinking and believing that these false messiahs were the messiahs is because they were subject to such difficulty and such servitude, either emotionally, financially, or physically. They were being oppressed, they were being beaten, they were being killed out. So when someone dangled the banner of salvation, freedom, returning to the land of Israel, there's hope, there's a future. Finally, we've waited and prayed for this for so long, and now it's here. Our problem today is the total opposite. We're very comfortable. Mashiach, what do you mean you're coming? I have a business meeting, a big deal, coming up Thursday, and it's a free lunch. I mean, you can't come now. We have the opposite problem now. So I think that's why it's important that, number one, we get a historical perspective about why we would have the concept of a false Messiah, and why, B, we need to look within ourselves to the concept of hoping for salvation, hoping for this better time, as Rabbi Aaron so eloquently said, because in a sense we're blessed with a blessing that sometimes acts as our greatest curse. Because it's easy to become complacent, it's easy to be content with our lot, it's easy to just say, look, I have a nice house, I have a comfortable life, I have friends, I don't want to give that all up. And therefore, it's really, you know, this short, small handout is really just the start of the concept of thinking about the past and also thinking about our own future and saying, I need to be able to make some changes now so I can adjust my antenna, that I can be open to the concept of talking and thinking about a salvation, that I can be open to the concept of a Mashiach, which would mean, yes, changes. It would mean returning to the land of Israel. And it would mean a totally new spiritual dynamic and maybe even physical dynamic in the world. And I have to start thinking along those lines, because it's so easy for us to be caught up in the concept of, oh, it's a nice, far-off, distant concept, but it has no relationship to me. Something to work on. As one rabbi once said, I may not be ready to want Mashiach, but I want to want the Messiah. And I hope to be on the level where I can actually want to have the future redemption. Okay, the floor is open for questions.
I have a question regarding the spirituality of the Messiah.
Right.
We know that Moses was, in a sense, a super Nabi.
Right.
There never was or will be anybody like him. Mm-hmm. How does that
coincide? A prophet like Moses.
How does that coincide with the spirituality of the Messiah?
Yeah. The the Rambam describes the Messiah as a little bit less than Moses.
Oh, I have hope.
There are different opinions as to why the prophecy of Moses is so unique. It seems that normally the question of the prophecy of Moses was not so much his tzidkus, in other words, his saintliness, but it's really the clarity of his vision. To see things in that clear state where his own ego, his own thing, does not get into the way. In other words, he totally sees it with total clarity. That was the uniqueness of Moses. And no other prophet before or after him had that clarity. But in terms of spirituality, Moses didn't have the monopoly on spirituality. Yes?
So it sounds like the Mashiach will not know necessarily for a fact that he's Mashiach. And at what point does he discover that? I mean, you know, or does he know? Will he know? And the false messiahs that have come now really in their hearts knew they weren't. I mean, can you talk about that? How does that work?
DNA. That's right. Right. Yeah. The Ramban, Nachmanides' approach, I don't know if it would go with the Ramban. It seems in his debate with the church, claimed that the Messiah, just like David HaMelech, King David was anointed, you know, by Shmuel HaNavi. There was a prophecy that anointed David HaMelech. There was going to be a prophecy given to Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu will anoint Mashiach. This is the Ramban's, and this is how he explains Nachmanides in his debates. I don't know if they have it translated in English. It's a wonderful. I think somebody did translate in English. He was forced. I think it was in the year 1263 to debate, like the Torah versus Christianity, with the high officials of the church. The head of the Dominicans, and there was a Jewish apostate, Pablo Cristiani, who debated the Christian side. The Ramban Nachmanides debated the Jewish side in front of King James of Barcelona. He wrote up the Ramban, the whole debate, is what they said. What he And this is part of it. So that's how, that's the Ramban's approach. How the Rambam, though, it doesn't seem to mention the fact. And he cites again the Bar Kokhba as the, as this citation that, that evidently that Rabbi Kiva really did not make a mistake, so to speak, as he followed all the rules, except, again, there's always, no one ever knows. It was the assumption or something. In that case, I guess the fact is that he was a person who rose up on his own and felt the need. There's this, assuming he was this scholar and spiritual person, this Bar Kokhba. And he got up on his own and saw the need and was successful. That itself is indicative, that the person is the Mashiach. That things just went his way, and he had the, the charisma as a leader, he had the inspiration himself, the courage to get up there, and his success as itself showed that he was the Mashiach. Like, it's self-fulfilling, so to speak. Like, and basically, if you're in doubt, you're not the Mashiach. At least according to the Rambam's approach. But according to Rambam, which is fascinating, he really looks at it as a parallel to the other kings who were anointed by prophets. Yeah.
If you consider the historical impact of Jesus in the world, why wouldn't he be considered the Messiah in his own time, not in our time?
No. In his lifetime, he had very little impact. Well, that's not the Messiah. That is a person who has had impact. Muhammad also had impact, as well as Buddha had impact, as well as Confucius had impact.
Made known the Jewish law.
What?
Jesus made the Jewish law known to the world.
No, he had, not basically himself, but through his disciples or through Paul. But that doesn't make one a Messiah. It's interesting, the Rambam, at the end of his whole work, Mishneh Torah, in a part which has been expunged by the church authority, the original work of the Rambam, he claimed that the rise of Christianity as well as Islam was in total a very positive force to get the world, to depaganize the world. In other words, that the world has now become, like the civilized world, monotheistic. And they all share a very common heritage. So that when Mashiach finally will come, it will not be a gigantic leap for these people to accept, because they've really groomed themselves for it all along. So the Rambam looks at it really in hindsight, historically, as a positive development, as of the evolution of Western culture, so to speak.
He
considered
himself Islamic.
What?
He considered Islamic by the Muslims.
What?
Rambam.
Listen, they could they can claim whatever they want, yeah, but he was, he was definitely a Jew.
But didn't he not?
There is a story that is told, which is not confirmed. Gretz brings down the story. And while he was traveling through Morocco, he left Spain. And the reason he left Spain, because it was controlled by Muslim fanatics that forced the Jews to convert or be killed. There is a story that for a short period of time he disguised himself as a Muslim to avoid death. And then as soon as he left, again practiced Judaism. But this is an unconfirmed story. But even if it would be true, it would only be for a short period of his life.
I have a question. When I read those psukim about the Mashiach, looks like Rabbi Akiva made a small mistake, because he was in the Middle East, he didn't know the world that we know today. The way I read those psukim, all the goyim from all the world after a terrible war, we come back to the Mashiach,
Let me just explain this. All Rabbi Kiva saw was just the initial stages of the fight.
Okay.
he didn't see, he had expected if Bar Kokhba would have been successful, this would have been the first of a whole series. He didn't think it had come now. He just, this is a candidate that will bring this whole, everything. But
it, coming to the 20th century.
Yeah.
By this birth, I can see that we are still waiting for a big war and mm-hmm. a big assault
mm-hmm.
before it's going to go to all the goyim come together to see you survive the coming day.
Yeah.
So we're just like in a period of transition now.
Correct.
Actually, we before, I don't know when, a big disaster.
Correct. I don't want to dwell on this. I want you to go to sleep in this.
We had a portion of Jews Hasidim that was talking about Mashiach coming now, and this is like, wait, we still have to bring all the Goyim, all the world as we know today, after a terrible war, he signed Emil Yerushalayim to the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah,
David.
Right. See, what they... okay, I'm not a chassid, so no, like, I can't talk to... Yeah, right.
Yeah.
They would basically claim that yes, he is Mashiach, well, he potentially would be Mashiach, but once he comes there and starts transforming them, then the Goyim will start. It's a whole process.
Right.
The wars will start once he starts coming there and starts doing things, and then they'll start declaring war on Israel.
Right.
You know,
this
before, right. This is just right.
What about year 6000 in relation to it?
Oh, that's a very good point. Let me just what? Yeah. There's a Medrash Tana Devei Eliyahu, which is quoted in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Tes 9a, that the world is going to last, according to this Medrash, for 6000 years. You have to realize that. When you're dealing with a medrash, you're dealing with things which may be tentatively true, you know, but it's not, you know, it's not something that must be, you know. When we deal with halacha, for instance, we have, let's say, an argument in opinions. Right? If we say this is the law, that doesn't mean that we know for sure that if we would speak to Moses right now and he would tell us is this what you taught Klal Yisrael? You're never sure, right, when you deal with halo. But when you deal with this majority, well, there's certain ways to deal with how do you live in a situation of unsurety when you don't know. Right? So you go with majority rule, there's a certain consensus. Right? So you say, because I have to live life one way or another, so I have to follow halacha. Right? Halacha, I have to go with, if it's a matter of what to do, I have to like take consensus of majority opinions. Well, I'm going to do this because in all probability this is the right way to do. But I never know, you know. I don't know for sure if this is the way Moses taught the Torah. But since the consensus of scholars maintain this is the way, okay, so I have to do something. So I follow, let's say, the majority rule. Right? But I never know. When it comes to, let's say, something which is not halacha, it's agadata. You're dealing with, you know, with Jewish philosophy, with Jewish history, with, you know, the other sections of Talmudic literature. There it's not a question of, I'm going to do something, it's just how to read a verse, right?
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I never know for sure who's right and who's wrong. I can't even go with majority, because it's not, majority is only a tool because I'm forced to do something. But I really don't know, right? In a similar sense, there's a medrash that the world is going to be 6,000 years old. It is widely quoted, so which gives it a certain credibility. On the other hand, it is still only a medrash, and there seems to be other opinions in the Talmud that have a different view. So just say that when we deal with it, you know, just in a sense, the medrash is, you know, it's...
Where is the medrash? Where can I read it?
Do you have a Gemara at home?
Yes.
It's on Avodah Zarah and Tes Omed Aleph. Towards the bottom of the owner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't that contradict?
No, but no. Just I didn't say anything yet. I'm just start, I just started. I just brought it. Anyways, just when you have this, there's a medrash. But many times in midrashim, like there's arguments of differences of opinion. There's no way of knowing what's right. You can bring it. It's widely quoted, so it's a respected opinion. You know. That opinion has the world is divided up into 6,000 years. The first 2,000 years are called Yemei Tohu, the unformed years. like prehist, not prehistory, but it's the insignificant history, so to speak. 2,000 years are the years of Torah. They start from the time when Avraham Avinu and Abraham started his message and started influencing people, and it lasted towards the end of the finishing of the Mishnah, you know, a little after the finishing of the Mishnah. So that's the next 2,000 years after that are the Yemois HaMashiach, the times of the Messiah. These are the times Messiah will most likely come. According to this Medrash, the world is only going to last 6,000 years. Mashiach has to come before the end of the 6,000 years. But there's nothing that we know when. In theory, you know, one of the interesting points brought about this Rabbi Akiva Maisa is that Rabbi Akiva, you know, with the Bar Kokhba, it happened the year 131, you know. The 6,000 years, the 4,000 years, in other words, the end of 4,000 years, meaning the next 2,000 years, was in the year 240. So this is like over 100 years before, you know, the Yemois HaMashiach. So how could Rabbi Akiva think that Bar Kokhba is Mashiach? It flies in the face of this Medrash. There are two approaches to this. First of all, as I said, it's a Medrash. It's not universally upheld. So Rabbi Akiva disagrees. But there's a second approach, which I think is a very important approach to be aware of, because it deals with goes far beyond this question of this, the 4,000 years of, you know, or Rabbi Akiva. And this is really an idea that the Talmud itself poses. He says, there's the idea of that Mashiach will come be'ito, in his time. In other words, there's a time for Mashiach to come. And then there's the idea of achishena. I will hurry up the process. If the Jews are worthy, it will happen even beforehand. So there's the outmost limit, so to speak. The game has to end by this time. And it could end earlier. That's achishena. In this sense, this is how they want to explain Rabbi Akiva, that really the idea of the 4,000 years, that is really the ideal time. But if the Jews would do tshuva, the Jews suffer terribly before this, the story with the Bar Kokhba. All of Egyptian Jewry and North African Jewry were annihilated. Cyprus Jewry were annihilated. Much of Babylonian Jewry suffered during the time. And I mean, it was a time of tsoros. And through all of this, and the Jews Hadrian the emperor had made terrible, had outlawed circumcision, and it seems other practices of Judaism. And the Jews resisted, and Rabbi Akiva sensed that this was a time that, because of their resistance and their mesiras nefesh, they were worthy that the Mashiach should come before the normal time. And that's why, even like there's an absence, we learn Eliyahu HaNavi is supposed to come. So perhaps he maintained, since it's only the beginning of the struggle, Eliyahu would eventually come, maybe, you know, later on, you know, to reveal himself. But it didn't. He felt that the Jews were worthy; it could come right now. But whatever the situation, I mean, whatever the case is, there is the idea of that there is a time, that there's a crucial time, that it will not go past a certain time. There is a maximum time, and then there is the that we could hurry it up. So we have this dynamics of hurrying it up and the maximum time. There's an interesting argument in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Salik Zayinon and Beis, in 97b, about Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, that the Jews, from the first paragraph, it seems, on the first page, the Jews have to do tshuva. They have to repent. That's Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. Rabbi Yeshua brings all kinds of citations that it seems that it's going to come if we don't repent. So there's a question what the text should read, you know, how to read the text. But the text that we have in our Talmud reads, Rabbi Yeshua, you know, Rabbi Eliezer says, points, hey, we have to do tshuva, we have to repent. So Rabbi Yeshua's reply is, Hashem will create, says, a melech kosher kohaman. As difficult as Haman, you know, in the Purim story. In other words, that the Jews will force to repent. In other words, the circumstances will be, the anti-Semitism will be, the Jews will be forced. And so, you know, Halavai says, I'm a goodness, and it should be good. You know, it should be, they should willfully. But if they don't, the pressure will be put that the Jews will be forced. At least that's how our text reads. You know, there's a time that it has to come. It can't go beyond that time. If we're not ready, it's going to come anyway. You know, that's really the idea. Is there any questions? Yeah.
Well, the thing is, if any implication, personal implication, that how a person can hasten the Yad HaMashiach.
Right.
One thing you say should repent. But is there something also in the personal life, also implication, something can happen in his own life, in his own personal life?
Yeah. Well, you know, your question reminded me of a story. This story is not true, but it's a great story. The story goes as follows. A guy was, he was by the Grand Canyon, and he was standing by the edge, looking down. And as he was so absorbed looking down, he lost his footing and started falling. You know, and it's a long way down the Grand Canyon. And on the way down, he's able to, there's a brush that's growing, the tree's growing out from the side of the Grand Canyon. He's able to grab hold of this tree that's growing outside and to hold on for dear life. You know, I mean, how long can you hold on to a tree in the middle of the lake? He's just hanging in there, you know. He sees it's about a mile down, you know, it's about 200 feet up, you know. You know, and he's scared, and there's nobody there, and he is really scared. And he starts praying like he never prayed before. And he says, God, says, if you're there, and if you really are there, says, you gotta help me. And he hears a voice. God appears, a voice from heaven. He says, don't worry. He says, I'll take care of you. Just one thing. Show me you believe in me and let go. He says, what? He says, let go. You know, he's looking up and he's looking down. He's hanging for dear life. And then he looks up again. He says, is there anybody else up there that can help me? One of the major problems we have in society today, as Rabbi Chaim basically touched upon it, we've never lived in such prosperity. You know, as a people, I mean, you know, there are people that saw us in the Dagon Alf, you know, man. There are people that are impoverished. I'm talking about individuals that have saw us. But as a people, especially Jews in America, really, it's unprecedented the prosperity historically. You know, everyone has their peckle, so to speak, their own. But just historically, it's unprecedented. All this wealth, you know, even the poorest person has hot and cold running water. You know what I mean? Which historically never existed. You have generally rugs. Almost everybody has a car. You know, there's a roof over their head, and that's just the simplest. And we live in a luxury that, you know, it's really unprecedented. The Torah deals with the problem of luxury, and when things are going good, we tend to forget God exists. That's human nature. We just forget. You know, I just wanted to share with you a tremendous insight. In Pirkei Avos, there is a passage. The mayor says, Kol HaMakayim. As a Torah Ma'oni, anyone who fulfills a Torah in a situation of poverty or deprivation, soifa l'kaima bo'isha, he will destine to fulfill it in wealth. V'kol hamavatla says mo'isha, anyone who nullifies, who does not fulfill the Torah despite the wealth that he has, soifa l'vatla mo'ini, then he will lose his wealth as well. There is a fantastic commentary of one of the major commentaries on Mishnayos, the Tiferes Yisrael from Yisrael Lifshitz, and he explains as follows. There are different tests in life. There's a test of poverty, there's a test of wealth. The test of wealth is a much more difficult test than the test of poverty. Because when a person's poor, no matter all the tzoras, you're humbled. You talk to God. If one person's wealthy, everything's going good. As long as he doesn't screw things up, everything's fine. You know what I mean? Who needs God? It's everything's fine. And therefore, wealth is a much greater nesoyim. It's a much greater test of one's spirituality, one's moral integrity, than poverty. Both are tests. A person could lose his bearings in poverty as well and become desperate and steal and lie. But in terms of tests, one versus the other, wealth is a much more difficult test to pass than poverty.
So the Tiferes Yisrael explains the mission as follows. He who passes the simpler test, the test of poverty, will then be given the more difficult test, the test of wealth. And he, on the other hand, who fails the test of wealth, just too hard for him, that wealth, the source of his problems, will be taken away. He will then be given a new and easier test, the test of poverty. Truly a beautiful and insightful explanation. We in America have the difficult test of wealth. But if we do pass that test, if we use our material blessings not to become less spiritual, but to raise up ourselves and the world about us, we will have brought Mashiach a little bit closer. As it says in the Talmud in Bava Basra 10a, G'doyla tzedaka shemekareves es ha-geula, greatest charity that it brings the redemption closer. By supporting those that study and teach Torah, by helping the truly needy, we can make it happen a little sooner.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.